it can ignite. And all you gotta do is bring the light. Cause a new light shine, cause a new light shine. Shalom, everybody. Welcome to the Light Lab Podcast, where we play with prayer and hold the gems of our sacred liturgy to the light. My name is Eliana, and I'm so glad to be with you today. I'm recording this from a hotel room in Los Angeles. We're near the airport, so if you hear any swoosh sounds, it's probably an airplane. I'm here for a couple of things. My friend Alexander Nemser and I are doing this Sidur translation project with a bunch of artists. It's an experiment that we've been thinking about for some time, bringing together six artists of a variety of different mediums and having them translate through their art. We're using the line Adonai Svatai Tiftach Ufi Yigitel Techa, which we have an episode about, by the way, the opening line to the Amidah. It's an opening. It's a prayer for help praying. There's all sorts of juicy stuff in there. And we're going to gather at this amazing place in LA called Der Nister on Sunday and see what happens. By the time this episode airs, the event will have happened. So maybe we'll get to update you on how it went. The second reason I'm here is for Kol Tefillah. Y'all might know the word tefillah if you're a regular. It means prayer and liturgy. Kol means all, and it also means voice. And it's a conference and gathering around tefillah that Temple Beth Am in LA puts on every year. And I often happen to be in LA while it's going on. So I'm really excited to get to pray and sing with some really incredible people. And I'm really excited to bring you this episode today, our interview with Rabbi Josh Kahan. I can't remember exactly when I met Rabbi Josh. I think our paths cross in and out, but we connected this year because he's an incredible tefillah educator and wanted to collaborate, see what we were doing in the Light Lab. And I said, of course, I love nerding out on tefillah and tefillah education. And it was such a joy to do that with Rabbi Josh Kahan today. So a little bit more about him. He's a tefillah educator in New York City, and he has compiled and edited the Yadid Nefesh Bencher and is introducing the new Yadid Nefesh Haggadah this spring. A bencher is a little book, I mean, they're usually kind of small, that includes prayers, songs, and blessings for the home. So Friday night at home, Shabbat morning, songs to sing around the table, other sorts of blessings. I have a bunch of Yadid Nefesh Benchers in my house right now. It's a really, really beautiful book. He's going to talk a lot more about that. He spent 11 years teaching Talmud and Tefillah at the LaFell School in New York and was the founder and director of the Northwoods Kollel at Camp Ramah in Wisconsin. He holds rabbinical ordination and a PhD in Talmud from the Jewish Theological Seminary. And I hope you enjoy my conversation with Rabbi Josh Kahan. Welcome to the Light Lab, Josh. It's so good to have you.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I was so excited when you reached out to connect a couple months ago. You are, is it correct for me to say, a tefillah nerd? As am I?
I am, and it is, I will say, I've been a tefillah nerd for longer than I have acknowledged to myself that I am such.
So we're wearing the mantle with pride today, I think.
Today we are, yeah.
Certainly. Well, I'd like to start by taking a look back, as we usually ask our guests. And I'm wondering what your relationship was to tefillah when you were a kid, as you were growing up.
It's funny. My father was a pulpit rabbi. I'm the youngest of four. And none of my siblings really had stayed connected to, were so interested in shul growing up or stayed connected thereafter. I was always the shul nerd. I was the 14-year-old who would raise his hand during the Torah discussions. So I feel like that's always been kind of a piece of, like, my, it's always been a kind of comfort space for me. I will say that somebody recently said it feels like people who care about tefillah seem to break down into those who were really primarily personal tefillah people and those who were communal tefillah people. And I've always been a communal tefillah person. I find it challenging to sort of like the davening by myself at home is a challenge. And like when I'm in a communal space with a real kind of shared experience, that's when I kind of really feel it. So I think that's been true forever.
Wow. And so even as a kid, do you think you could have articulated at the time what was meaningful and powerful about it? Or looking back, do you have a sense of what that was?
I think that part of it, certainly when I was a kid, was that I was good at it and felt comfortable with it. Mm-hmm. And so whether I was leading or even just as a participant, I felt I had something to contribute and to offer to the other people in that space. And that was always a feeling I liked. And I think the models of sort of meaningful experience were communal models, right? I never related to the people who would sit by, you know, even in shul, would like stand by themselves and have these, right? Some people sort of watch the rabbi or whoever who has this very personal internal thing. The people whose voices and presences I remember are the people who brought people in and made people want to be a part of it.
Hmm. And what are some other, you know, we're talking about your home synagogue. As you grew into adolescence, young adulthood, where else were you experiencing those communal, powerful, positive experiences?
I went to USY. I was part of USY as a kid, and there was always one of the nice things about USY, especially growing up in a conservative synagogue, where there was a pretty small circle of involved teenagers, it was to just kind of come together with other like-minded folks. And I enjoyed that. And then when I got to Israel, I spent a year in Israel, junior year, studying in yeshiva and being part of this kind of whole religious community in Israel. And there was really a different level of like spiritual engagement with the davening, especially with singing. And I feel like I really brought back that sense that actually what I grew up with is only a shadow of what can be.
Taking kind of a different tack as we look backwards, I'm wondering what your idea or understanding or relationship with God was like when you were in services as a kid, kind of feeling proud, feeling mastery over the prayers, feeling comfortable in community. Was God part of that equation at all?
In a general way, I don't think that I had sort of definite shaped ideas about what God is or sort of, I didn't have a theology in that sense. And I think that that's been sort of a consistent thing for me throughout my learning and my teaching, is that it always feels like a mistake when people feel like we should be talking about God and what we believe about God and having these, right? We don't need to come to any consensus about what God is. What we really need is to figure out how to experience connection with God. And that's a much easier thing to talk about, yeah. I think. And an easier thing to agree that we're striving for.
I think for me, and I don't know if I've talked about this on the pod before, but I really resonate with that for me, the divine is experienced. And so it's more about experience than belief. I find belief to be an unhelpful binary, as most binaries are. And again, I'm like taking what you said and thinking back on my own life. I was also a kid that loved going to shul, and I felt something communal. I don't know if I could have articulated, but that kind of buzzy feeling of togetherness and connection, perhaps that was an experience of the divine. I just, you know, didn't have the words to put to it then.
Right. You know, I used to have in the year, especially that my first year in yeshiva, where I was in an Orthodox yeshiva, and it was an article of faith in that people, my fellow students, they were certain that they believed in God and therefore felt commanded to do mitzvot and participate and learn Torah and participate in this community. And I was always totally, totally convinced that they had it all backwards, that they found meaning and structure and belonging and inspiration in being a part of this community of practice, all those different pieces of practice, and that led them to want to embrace the set of beliefs that were the sort of entry ticket to it. I just felt like that relationship is opposite, because it's when people become Baal Tshuva, right? They don't start by realizing in this abstract way, I believe such and such about God. They find a community that they feel at home in, that inspires them, that moves them, that makes them, gives them something that they've been lacking. Hmm.
That's a really interesting way to put it. It makes a lot of sense to me, though, you know, is it tactful to try to, you know, say, actually, it's not because you believe in God, but I think it also adds an important dimension of why Jewish communal practice and why taking on more mitzvot might be something that someone wants to do and that gives them a lot of structure and community, whereby from the outside looking in, one might only think of them as, you know, more strictures and more control and not kind of the beautiful aspects of that.
Right.
When you said it was interesting that when you experienced prayer in Israel, you realized that what you had grown up with, as lovely as it was only a shadow of what it could be. Do you have memories of other prayer experiences kind of through your young adulthood that were like, oh, it could be so much more X, like, and what you think that X would be?
In terms of earlier than that? Well, I will say that...
Or later.
Well, so the first thing is when I think about where does my own style of davening and of leading davening really sort of come from, I learned it from a guy named Steve White. He'd grown up in our shul, and he was then an old guy, which meant late 20s probably at the time. But he would come back and lead kind of the overflow service for the high holidays. And he was one of those like beautiful neshama balei tefillah who just, you just feel, you felt inspired just kind of being brought, you know, sort of led by him. He had that presence, and he had a lovely voice, but not an overpowering one. But not only did he practically sort of teach me the nusach, certainly for the holidays, but I often find myself kind of channeling that and trying to emulate that sense of humble but yet energized kind of presence.
Mm. And, you know, it's a podcast, so not everybody can see, but I even saw it in your body language when you were describing it, your eyes closed and there was a little smile on your face and your hands went up, like this particular posture. And, you know, part of it might be, oh, the person who is the shaliach tzibur, the kind of emissary of the community, is having a meaningful experience here and like inviting me in and along for the ride, which I think makes a big difference.
Yeah. And like that combination of this person is having their own meaningful tefillah experience, but they care that we're there.
Hmm.
Right. They're holding us by the hand and saying and leading us there, as opposed to someone who is emotive and so invested that it's hard to connect with them.
Right. Because sometimes it kind of flips over into the other direction, that the person who's leading is in their own world, having their own experience, and the rest of us are just kind of there, or we're like keeping them from doing, you know, from feeling as deeply as they might want to. And it feels like a burden. It's like, oh, why are we here? So that kind of, that balance is really crucial. I know you have a relationship with Camp Ramah. Mm-hmm. Did you go there as a camper?
So no, I had one sleepaway experience when I was a little too young to have it, and swore it off for the rest of childhood, and went back only as a staff member, but at my senior year of college, I went for the first time to Ramah, Wisconsin, and that turned into, you know, 10 years of really amazing building that I was able to do.
Yeah, I'd love for you to tell us about that, as well as what you found meaningful and or challenging about tefillah at camp.
So I think primarily my friend Arya Bernstein and I were building this Beit Midrash program, a study program for some of the campers, and then we were able to bring in a kollel, a small group of college students who came to camp to sort of learn full time. Many of those students are people that I'm still close with and who have become great teachers in their own right. And the first thing I will say is that it was an amazing opportunity for me as a 25-year-old sort of starting rabbinical school to be able to teach Gemara courses on a high level to really motivated students for 9 intensive weeks and all the other pieces of that. It was also kind of, I still think back in amazement that the director of the camp, David Soloff, who really had no experience with the kind of yeshiva world culture. It was really not his world. And yet he bought the notion that it was good for the camp to kind of bring that into them, into that space. And he both invested in us and was not threatened by our doing something that was not in his comfort zone. So I'm always kind of grateful to him for that. Tefillah was always a challenge. I don't know that in the years that I was at camp, I wasn't so focused on tefillah. I think the place that I almost accidentally had the biggest impact, or that was the biggest long-term thing for me, was actually that both we had Thursday night and Shabbos afternoon singing, which was kind of part of the yeshiva culture piece that we were bringing in, and that grew from a little niche thing into sort of a major thing at camp and spread to other camps and kind of spread into USY, kind of something that really had been, it was a piece of the culture that had been really missing in the 80s and 90s. Conservative institutions really held anything that felt orthodox at arm's length. And some of those summers of packing the camp Chag Ha'Ochel with 250 campers and singing these angsty, emotive Seudah Shlishit songs. Those are things I've had more people, I've run into more people over the years who sort of look back and remember those experiences than almost anything else I did at camp. And people who went to rabbinical school and sort of traced that engagement back to those evenings, kind of singing and just like feeling swept up in the music and the emotion, and even when they didn't have words for what they were and for what they were feeling or what they needed, like that it was something that they really felt reached them in a way that nothing else did. And I think that, you know, when I look back at it, sort of that was the beginning of my kind of transitioning from a Talmud person to a tefillah person. Hmm. In the like, as looking back, I was like, that's where I was able to have the biggest impact and the thing that kids needed that they weren't necessarily getting, and where I felt like camp had so much potential.
Absolutely. For those connective experiences, it seems like that is a theme that is showing up in your life, in your tefillah life. How beautiful that, you know, collective effervescence. I think that's Durkheim, right. That kind of thing we can't necessarily name, that's powerful. As someone who has memories of those things from my own days at camp, thank you. And I'm wondering, Ramah Jerome, and also on staff at Wisconsin and Nyack and other camps, that was definitely a big part of our experience, in my experience. This flip to becoming a tefillah person, a tefillah rabbi, how did that play itself out as you were ordained and went into the field?
One of the things that now, that when I talk about tefillah, that I find myself saying often, which certainly was true for me, is that schools hire subject teachers. They don't hire tefillah educators. They hire subject teachers and then sort of draft them to work with tefillah. When I started at the LaFalle School after I finished my doctorate, there were lots of people who had tefillah responsibilities and very few people who wanted to be leading tefillah. So I kind of immediately, as someone who was comfortable as a tefillah leader, as shlich tzibur, etc., kind of naturally kind of moved into that, into the role of one of the sort of like lead tefillah people, because most people just didn't want to be doing it. A big piece of it was I was part of the first cohort of the Pardes Aleinu L'Shabeach, this sort of prayer education project, which really kind of ran sort of seriously for a number of years. And then as things go, their focus shifted. But that was a really kind of eye-opening experience, both because it was just a really well-done program, but also bringing together, like if you think about the landscape of day schools and you bring together the 30 or whatever people who think tefillah is important enough in school to come to a conference like this, you get to meet the people who get it in the who see it in the way that you see it, and that in and itself was powerful. But also that every one of us found ourselves in contexts where the people around us didn't quite get it, and we're asking not only, well, what do we do in our minyan to make it better, or what can we add, but how do we help our colleagues to both embrace the role and to be tefillah educators, right? Because that's a term we talked about this a bunch even in then, and I've had that conversation multiple times, that even the notion of describing oneself as a tefillah educator is something that so many of my school colleagues sort of were resistant to.
Where do you think that resistance or that challenge comes from? What makes it so hard? I'm thinking not just for people to take on the mantle of tefillah educator, but to do tefillah in a school setting like that.
There are a few things that I found. One is that people take a job in an area that they feel confident in, they feel like they have command of, and they know what they're doing, and they often feel that they don't have the expertise in tefillah the way that they do in their subject area. Also, leading tefillah well is a very different kind of thing than teaching a course well, right? And if you are a classroom teacher, you have a clear map of what needs to happen in your classroom in order to engage students in the material, to teach the material at the level you want, to assess whether they've learned it. And you don't have those same structures in tefillah. A lot of people talk about, well, tefillah is such a personal thing, whether it's personal for me and therefore I don't want to have to be putting my spirituality on display, or it's personal for everyone, so who am I to be telling you how to be spiritual or how to connect with God? And the fourth thing, I think that's four things, is there is this frustrating sort of assumption that is just locked in for so many people that school or camp tefillah, I think certainly school tefillah, and I think camp tefillah to a certain extent also, that there's the ceiling is halfway decent, is as good as you can strive for. And getting kids to behave is basically the only job of someone who's tefillah staff, the only thing that's even that you could even have a hope of achieving. And that is also makes it feel like something you're not going to invest a lot in.
Right. And it also seems with the bar that low, like, why are we doing it if it's going to feel like pulling teeth and a challenge? So let's take it kind of on the flip side. Like, what are the opportunities of tefillah in, we might say, a camp, a Ramah camp or a day school setting? I'm thinking in particular about the challenge and opportunity of regularity of doing something every day or multiple times a week. Why, you know, if someone was going to say, well, why should we even bother? Why are we doing tefillah here? Like, what might you say?
So a bunch of things, but to start with, camps and Jewish day schools exist to cultivate, to give Jewish education, to cultivate a sense of connectedness to Jewish experience and Jewish ritual and Jewish practice. And tefillah is the place where that happens most intensively, both because academic classes are still going to feel like academic classes, even if they're on in Judaic subjects, whereas tefillah is entirely sort of Judaic. So at camp, you think about the Jewish experiences at camp, classes are, those like Yahadut classes are often an afterthought, certainly for the kids, if not for the staff, whereas tefillah is happening all the time. And like tefillah is a huge proportion of their camp experience. And I will say that when former campers look back on their camp experiences and have really positive association, Judaic associations with camp, they almost always include or focus on tefillah experiences. And just to kind of add on to that, tefillah is also the thing that is most likely to bring them, to bring those kids to active participation in a Jewish community when they're in college or young adults, right? When people come to shul, what draws them to shul, right? If they have some sort of positive association with tefillah spaces. So that's one kind of big piece. The other big piece is that tefillah is the space where we have the chance to kind of nourish them emotionally and spiritually, to energize them, to help them to fly in a way that we just don't. It's really hard to do in other contexts. You know, school off feel like it's the space in school certainly that doesn't feel like school. And so if you use that space well, you can get at emotional and spiritual places that you otherwise can't access. And great, like really meaningful tefillah can shape how they feel about their whole school experience and their whole Judaic experience.
Yeah. And, you know, a good experience can lead to more and seeking that out, and a bad experience can lead to the opposite.
Right.
So, yeah. And I love this idea of tefillah being a place where students can be nurtured and the kind of socio-emotional spiritual side can be engaged in a way that it isn't always. If a day school teacher or a camp counselor were to approach you and say, I want tefillah to be that, what are a couple of things that I can do to make either the tefillah spaces I'm leading in or the tefillah spaces that I'm a participant in more like that? Now that I've said it, I wonder if those are different answers for the camp counselor and the school teacher, but maybe they're the same. I don't know. What do you think?
There are certainly, it's both. I mean, there are certainly significant differences and a lot of overlap. I think of the answer to that question on a few different levels, right? There are sort of, what are the sort of simple, concrete changes in how we go about things that we could just try and see how they see and see their impact? Things like, you know, doing more things out loud, because especially kids who aren't sort of otherwise immersed in and fluent in tefillah, silent reading can you know, tend to lose them. But one of the things that I really focused on with the teachers I worked with at my school was really shifting the balance of positive and negative interactions, getting into this space where we're constantly shushing and disciplining, and that's the primary way we interact with kids. I would always be moving around the room, having sort of nonverbal, just like smiling at a kid, giving a kid a high five, or standing next to a kid and like singing at them and getting them to, like, even if it's silly, like getting them to be part of that experience. Variation is one that I think people are very locked into. Well, we have a matbea. This is the order of things that we do, and gets boring pretty quickly. Being willing to say, hey, you know what? We're gonna have a little variation. We're gonna some days spend a little more time in this piece, other days, spend a little more time in that piece, days when we're going to do everything and days when we're going to like cut back and really dwell on one piece for a longer time. And developmentally, like really thinking about, this, and this gets a little bit more at the sort of bigger picture and kind of that second level of making sure that our fifth grade tefillah is different than our sixth grade tefillah and our seventh grade tefillah. That not only can we say, oh, here are our goals for fifth grade tefillah, but based on those goals, sixth grade tefillah is then going to like have progressed to doing something more complex and build on what we've done. So that's the second piece, is really thinking across, not only across a summer or a school year, but across multiple years. And the third level, which is in a sense more of a sort of an investment kind of thing, is the faculty who are leading tefillah need to kind of spend time exploring what it means to them, what it means to them to be prayers. This is one of those like pardes words that I have kind of always held on to, like a prayer as a place prayers to, as opposed to a prayer leader, right? What it means to them to be a prayer, what they imagine it means to, it could mean to their students to be prayers, and then what strengths they bring to being prayer educators. And that perfection isn't meant to be one of them, right? That they can have, we all have things that we lack and things that we're not good at, but really if we focus on and remind ourselves that there are, even in our imperfection, there are gifts that we have, there are things that we can bring, there are things that we can model in a genuine way, and we don't feel like releasing people from feeling like frauds.
You know, Ellen says, that's why it's called a spiritual practice, right? It's not a spiritual perfect, it's a spiritual practice. Right. These are great ideas, and I hope...
And that's then the fact that that's true for the adults, right? Hopefully is creating a permission for the kids not to have to open up to this without having all the answers.
Right. Because even if you have been praying from a siddur all your life, there are ways in which we are all beginners and that it is a practice for all of us. And that's really important to remind and also to model for ourselves. Yeah. I hope people can take some of these ideas and if you're in a place where you're leading tefillah, kind of see what happens. I want to pivot now to talking about one of your projects that I certainly have benefited from, which is the bencher that you made. A bencher being one might call it like the liturgy of the Jewish home, like liturgy for home life, including Friday night at home, Shabbat blessings. We're actually on this Shabbat at home journey right now in the roundtable episode, so it's kind of perfect. I'm wondering what was the journey from idea to creation? What got you started thinking, oh, out of all of the little books that I've seen, I think there's room for a new one, and I have some ideas of what to do about it.
The way I got into the sort of space of book creation, my father, Zichrono Livracha, was the editor of the Shabbat and Festival Sim Shalom, which he finished in 1998, and then the weekday one was finished in 2001. And that's when he started talking about, well, the next installment should be a bencher. And because the only conservative bencher at the time was the USY B'Kol Echad. And I had just come back from discovering this whole world of song and spirituality in Israel that I also hadn't grown up with, and I knew he hadn't. And then I said to him, well, I have actually learned to sing and sort of and learned a world of Zmirot that you don't know. What, like, let me sort of like give, take a shot at laying out and thinking and planning out that book. So it really started from the sense, his initial sense that ought to happen, and my kind of saying, let me take that on. But the other piece was, as at the same time, we were starting to get to the age where our friends were getting married, and there were, and everyone had the like, well, what bench are we going to use for our wedding? And there were, there were significant kind of shortcomings to any, to all of the available options. And so that sort of convinced me that beyond the, like, the conservative movement as a sort of an official thing, that there was my own world of people who were looking for a thing that they weren't finding. And the most, the biggest sort of misconception that I found was people assumed they weren't finding it because everyone was idiosyncratic and wanted something different. And it turned out not to be true in sort of for the most part. But like for the most part, the people that I knew were most looking for very similar things, and they just had never been put in a book. So I kind of set out to make that a venture that had all of the zmirot that my sort of liberal yeshiva friends wanted to sing and weren't in any of the egalitarian ventures, that had the transliterations that, you know, if you look at ventures, so many either don't have transliterations or they're hard to read and hard to use, and transliterations that would really invite people to participate. Just a book that was felt complete, felt like it was accessible for different kinds of people, and that would be egalitarian without being sort of defined by that, right? I mean, I think one of the things that became more important to me as I was working on it and talking to people who were in this kind of space between the conservative and orthodox worlds, the kind of space that Hadar has grown in, and Chovaveh and some of these other institutions, was a book that was sort of careful to be egalitarian, but that that your orthodox friends would pick up and be like, this feels like a bencher. And then I got to do, I was working on a doctorate at the time, and where you have to like really go so deeply into such narrow things. And in the bencher, I could take a text and find one nugget of wisdom that, right, and like give you a paragraph of commentary that just something to think about, and like touch on something and move on. I really liked that kind of writing. I'm the kind of person who I'm always the person who writes the greeting cards in our family, the mazel tov cards for bnei mitzvah and weddings, and because I take 45 minutes to write three sentences, but the three good sentences.
Right. It can be hard to write compactly like that. That's a great skill.
And it came out, I promised my wife that we would sell out the first printing, and so we wouldn't actually lose money on it. But it's been 15 years and wow, People are still buying it. So it feels like it met a need.
Certainly. I definitely have a bunch of them in my house right now. When I talk about the Sidur, I often talk about the Sidur as a series of choices. First of all, the choice of the person who originally prayed the prayer or remixed different lines of Tanakh to call out to the universe in some way. But it also is a series of choices with regard to how the Sidur was put together, not just mm-hmm. certain things that the morning and certain things in the afternoon and certain things in the evening, but like how big the font should be and what the translations are like. So I'd love for you to talk us through some of the choices that you had to make to put the bencher together and how you made those.
Right. So one piece was transliteration. I was very big on having a consistent transliteration system. I have this, all of my sort of Jewish academic friends, when they pick it up, they're like, the first thing they're like, ooh, there's a transliteration guide at the beginning, right? And like, this feels academic. Like, good, I'm at home. But I did a lot of like testing, like bringing different spellings and transliterations to people who don't know Hebrew, and figuring out which versions enabled them to get closest to decoding what the Hebrew is supposed to sound like. So that was one big piece. You sort of make the decision when you're translating whether like what your purpose is. For me, the purpose was to have English that someone could read and feel like they understand that text as a whole. So I was always translating for meaning, idiomatic for the sense, and not in a sort of word for word kind of way. Or a lot, you know, sort of if you're writing a translation where you're assuming that people are reading the Hebrew and are going to want to check what does this word mean, you need to be much more precise in that sense, right? As opposed to an English text that's readable. And one of the big advantages for me, I wouldn't have known this when I started working on it, but that distinguished what I was able to do from Ani Mizmirot and Bekol Echad and other and the NTSY bench and other benches that had come out previously is InDesign. The graphic design program had just come out with their Middle East version. And so we were able to sort of really design and craft beautiful pages in a way that was like for instance, I mean, when Leah Salomon did Ani Mizmirot, which was maybe 6 or 8 years before I started working on this, she was working with text box with tables and text boxes in Microsoft Word. And I had someone really being able to sort of craft the look of a page so that it felt like an elegant and crafted book. You know, I just finished this Haggadah, which is in shipping boxes on the on the way here and as we speak. And it was even more true with that you have a book where people are going to sit with for however many hours sitting at Seder, working through a text they're not so familiar with. It needs to feel easy to look at and just pleasant. And honestly, like the difference between a lovely text and sort of opening up that old Ktav or one of these sort of old Haggadot is a real difference in what you expect of that ritual. I really think about that a lot, that what it looks like creates expectations about what the experience is going to be like.
Do you have, and maybe you don't, but do you have an example, whether from the Bencher or the Haggadah, of something that you were thinking about including and then ended up not including because it didn't fit the goals or the values that you wanted to be guiding in that instance? Or the opposite, is there something that you weren't sure about including that you ended up doing because it felt more aligned with the mission?
I will say that with the Haggadah, in my original plan for the Haggadah, one of the first things that I kind of really realized more fully in sort of really sitting with the Haggadah is the extent to which and the reasons why the story that we sort of expect to be there isn't there. And so I had this idea of having an appendix with like 4 or 5 different styles of retellings of the story. And I actually had several friends lined up who were like, I was like somebody who's a young adult writer, someone who is a poet, someone who kind of writes more kind of mystical stuff, right? Each were going to write like their 3 or 4 page version of a telling of the story. And I was really into that idea. And then, but I kept coming back to, and as people asked me, well, the first question I always would get asked about the Haggadah is, well, what's your take or what's your shtick? And right now, what I tell them, the point is actually not to have a shtick. The point is to figure out what's the text that you find yourself frustrated, like, why doesn't this exist? And create that, right? Create a base text that you can feel like this is just the Haggadah, but like in a form that I really want to use it. So as I kind of defined it in that way, those extras felt like they didn't have a place, at least in the printed book. Fantasies about, a website with all these sort of additional resources and stuff. And that's one of the things that I still hold on to, but certainly in terms of the printed book, it didn't make it in. But an example of the reverse is I have 5 pages in the Bencher of the Brachot and songs for Hanukkah. Because I figured that it's easier to pull a Bencher off and find the Brachot for Hanukkah than to like take down a Sidur and to figure out what section it's in. But also because books get printed in like these large sheets. So you really need to think in terms of units of 8 pages. And I had 139 pages and 5 pages left over. I was like, what am I going to put in those 5 pages? And so Hanukkah got in.
That's great. It is very handy to have everything for the home together. I want to ask you about the title of the Bencher, and also what I'm assuming is also going to be the title of the Haggadah potentially, Yadid Nefesh, which has become the moniker, maybe the brand. Were you thinking about other titles, and why did you end up going with Yadid Nefesh? And how would you even translate Yadid Nefesh?
I did have like a list of title. I mean, I had been a whole brainstorming of different title ideas. There wasn't another one that I was seriously considering. This one just kind of jumped out at me. I think the thing that made it obvious once I hit on it is that it actually turns out that Yadid Nefesh is the poem that begins and ends Shabbat, and kind of like captures that sense of that the goal of Shabbat is connectedness, a feeling of yididut, of closeness. So, and to the extent that the Bencher sort of after Brichat HaMazon sort of goes from candle lighting and those rituals through Zmirot, through, you know, the songs that I think of as Suda Shlishit songs, even though there are more songs than that now. But and then it was obvious no matter what else was in the book that Havdalah would be the last page of the book, the last couple pages of the book, because Havdalah's at the end, right? So I think that envelope of beginning and end made it feel natural. I did think for the Haggadah about Pesach appropriate titles, because Yadid Nefesh is obviously very much a Shabbat poem and Shabbat sort of therefore a Shabbat phrase. But at some point I realized like the reason I think people will really take a serious look at this book in the first place is because people have seen the Bencher, and therefore it wouldn't make any sense to call it anything other than Yadid Nefesh. So in that sense, the Haggadah is the Yadid Nefesh Haggadah because of the brand.
Right. It all gets to be under the Yadid Nefesh umbrella. Right. I love that idea of bookending. We love an inclusio, right? Something that connects it from the beginning to the end. And I'm wondering, you know, as we kind of wrap up this conversation, what your hopes might be for someone who is utilizing your Bencher, utilizing your Haggadah. What do you hope for them?
I think what I hope for a user of the books is what I hope for student for my students in the school, which is, you know, we're always trying to sort of figure out this balance between training kids in sort of building their literacy and giving them sort of different kinds of ways to access the kind of spiritual experience and what's the relationship between those. And my goal has always been to give them the literacy so that they're comfortable enough with the rituals so that they can use it as a canvas to paint their own spiritual landscape. And I'm not presuming to tell them what that landscape should look like. I want to give them materials to be able to craft it. And I think with the Bencher and the Haggadah, I think the same. Like what I want from this Haggadah is for it to feel like a base text that you can have a pile of, you can pass around the table. Everyone can kind of be on the same page. Everyone can feel like they can access the text and feel comfortable with it and keep track of where they are and what's going on. And use that as a springboard. And then all of the different ways that we turn the Shabbat rituals, turn the Seder ritual into a deep, a meaningful experience kind of leaps off from that, right? And all of the activities and readings and poems and other things become possible once you feel like the text is welcoming you. So I hope that like, My hope is that they are a canvas that all types of people feel they can draw on.
I mean, wow. I'm envisioning that canvas. What a beautiful metaphor. And I'm also just feeling so, have like the warm and fuzzies thinking about your journey from experiencing powerful communal moments of song and prayer to creating those and bringing people in and then making a bencher and a Haggadah so that even more people can have more access to those connective quality moments. So thank you. I guess thank you for sharing that gift with us.
Thank you.
And where can people find your books? And is your Haggadah available currently?
So I had the good fortune of starting with the bencher, working with a designer who also has this great website and is a distributor. So it's called Haggadahs R Us. And he's the one who has sold the bencher since it was first in print. And I am so grateful that I do not ever have to deal with orders and distribution, God forbid. And the Haggadah will also be sold through Haggadahs R Us. It is it's available for pre-order now. It will be ready to be sent out sometime in early February, but it's open for orders now. And I'm excited. I'm excited to use it. Look, you know what? I printed a beta version this past Pesach to give a few families a chance to try it out, and I got all sorts of feedback and corrections and suggestions, but the most important thing was knowledgeable families who said, oh, we can look forward to using the real thing. This feels like a book we could use. So I'm really hopeful that people embrace it. And I look forward to that. And I will say, like, one of the things about being a classroom teacher is it's a very sort of insular environment. Not a lot of people outside of your classroom see what's going on within it. It's always been a precious thing to me in that I have had this one thing out there that people across a wide range of communities and places encounter little pieces of my Torah. I've always really sort of appreciated that. And so I hope that this will be the same.
Amen. And now, listeners, if and when you buy or come across these books out in the wild, you can feel a little more connected. We don't always know the people. We often don't know the people who are making the decisions about what our Siddurim and our benchers and our Haggadot look like. But now you know one, and I hope that that can help you connect to those experiences even more. So thank you so, so much, Josh, for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been great.
And thank you so much for listening. Our editor is Christy Dodge. Our show notes are done by Yaffa Englander. Please check out our amazing show notes. Our podcast kit producer is Rachel Kaplan. Take a look at lightlab.co for show notes and transcripts and all sorts of cool things coming up. Follow us on social media. We hope that you have a beautiful and blessed day wherever it is that you are, and we will see you again real soon.